On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We continue our Focus on the County series. This morning, a conversation with first-term Harford County Executive Barry Glassman. He was one of three county executives elected in the Baltimore region in the 2014 Republican wave led by Governor Larry Hogan. Harford County is wrestling with a tenacious problem of opioid addiction, the tensions between rural and suburban land use, environmental contamination, and other issues. I'll talk to County Executive Barry Glassman on what's ahead for Harford County. Then, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The Lord of Flies, an adaptation at the Annex Theater of William Golding's chilling 1954 novel of not quite the same name. Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning's coming right up after this hour's headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us this morning. We're going to begin today with another installment in our Focus on the Counties series. Over the past few weeks, we've heard from the county executives of Baltimore, Howard, and Anne Arundel counties. This morning, I have the pleasure of welcoming Harford County Executive Barry Glassman to the studio. Mr. Glassman is 54 years old, a native of Havre de Grace. He's a Republican elected by a wide margin in 2014. He is a graduate of Washington College in Chestertown. Before entering politics, he worked as an insurance investigator and held positions with Baltimore Gas and Electric. He was a member of the Harford County Council in the 1990s. He was a state delegate from 1999 to 2008 and a state senator from 2008 to 2014. Mr. Glassman, it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
So let's talk a little bit first about stormwater and the stormwater runoff. When you were elected in 2014, soon into your administration, you submitted legislation that got rid of the stormwater fee in Harford County, which had been assessed at about $12.50 a household, as I understand it. One plan had it at $125 a household.
Right.
It had been reduced, and you got rid of that. Before we talk about the finances of all of this, refresh folks' memories about what the stormwater fee was intended to pay for. What are the goals of stormwater remediation?
Well, I was in the Maryland Senate when we first debated the stormwater fee, and it did not have the moniker of rain tax back in that. That's before all the political ramifications of the fee in general. But the long-term goal was to provide a funding mechanism which would allow counties to address stormwater runoff as we look to restore the bay and part of a national settlement with the EPA regarding stormwater and water quality. So in general, that was the goals. For the first time, it was a mandate to counties to raise a fee. I just from my legislative experience, normally, whether it was Nutrigen Management, ENR, BNR, and so forth with our septic and treatment plants, normally the state would have the counties move ahead with these goals. This bill was a little different in that it mandated a fee.
You were required to submit a financial assurance plan, which basically would assure the EPA and the state of Maryland that, you know, there was a plan in place for Harford County to address this problem that everybody agrees existed. It was the deadline to submit it was just a few weeks ago, on the 1st of July. So what's in it and what do you need to achieve to meet the requirements?
I think all along in Harford County, we have a long history through our local soil conservation districts and our planning that we're aware of water quality issues. The Harford County Council recently passed our assurance plan that will go, would be forwarded on to the Maryland Department of Environment. One important thing that we did when we repealed the rain tax per se in the early part of my term was in fact rededicate a portion of our recordation tax, which had traditionally gone to some water and sewer capital funding. And so we took that money, that dedicated funding stream, and we have leveraged it with bond funding to provide some additional bond fundings for our project. So that $6 to $8 million, and we are beginning to move forward a year and a half into this with many projects. I'm pleased to announce, I'll make a little news, that the DNR Chesapeake Bay and Coastal Trust Fund has just awarded the county an additional $2 million for some retrofits and for four additional projects. We have 15 projects underway. So I think with the dedicated funding stream and some of the work that we've done through grant funding, that we have close to 20 projects underway to address water quality. And we've said all along that our goal is to work with EPA, with MDE, to achieve these water quality goals to restore the bay. Coming from a conservative county, the politics of forcing a stormwater fee on constituents was not really an option. So what I've done is try to find a way to reach the goal and work with the appropriate authorities to do that. And I think we're dedicated to doing that.
It'll come to no surprise to you that you have your skeptics when it comes to this. There are some folks who don't think that the plans that you have in place are adequate. There are some who estimate costs of around $22, $23 million to meet the goals in this plan. And the kind of money that you're talking about generating, I mean, even with this new grant now that you've just announced, maybe it gets to 10, something like that. How do you address the shortfall?
Well, I think, as a local executive, and I've had to learn this myself over the last 18 months, there are policy goals and what is achievable, and there's always the fiscal reality. And coming into Harford County, we had tripled our debt. Our fund balance had been drawn down to $3 or $4 million. So the fiscal realities of what you can do and afford to do is quite different than what you'd like to do. And you also have to balance the fact that your local business community, your residential families that are having difficulty, you know, paying student loans and all the other increasing costs. So it's finding the right balance to reach the goals. I've always tried to approach this as reaching the goal, but doing it in a way that we can afford to do it. And there is an argument that at $20 million, even with 15 projects going on right now, whether my staff and there is the capability to complete the projects. So I think we've found the right balance.
Capability meaning financial capability, or just the person hours that it takes to oversee
exactly,
them?
The planning, the permitting, the design.
Give me an example of the kinds of projects you're doing to address this issue of, you know, clean water and saving the bay.
Some of them are of course impervious pavers, rain gardens, conservation landscaping. The county has the Deer Creek watershed, the Foster Branch, the Winter Run.
Because the mandate is, for example, in these so-called impervious surfaces, you know, concrete, asphalt, you've got to remediate 20% of it. There's a lot of concrete and asphalt in Harford County, just like there is everywhere else in the world.
Right. So
how do you do that?
A lot of this is retrofit. We design things better than we did 20 years ago when Harford County's, you know, first real growth cycle began. So a lot of these projects are retrofitting and doing design work to make stormwater collection, the filtering, a lot better than we did. So that's a big undertaking. And some of the projects, in fact, have water quality monitoring systems attached to them so that we can begin right now, other than the final product that may reach the Deer Creek or the Susquehanna River, we don't really have the capability to work with the Geological Survey and all the water quality collection agencies to see how well we're doing. So three or four of these projects are actually give us the capability to begin to track water quality and, in fact, how well we are doing. And I think through data collection, we'll have a better idea of how well Harford County's moving the ball down the field.
Mm-hmm. This is Focus on the Counties here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall in 88.1 WIPR. My guest this morning, the County Executive of Harford County, Barry Glassman. You've been in politics from the county council through the state legislature and now as a county executive for quite a while, 20-something years, I guess. You were in business before that. You mentioned, you know, the distance sometimes between what you want to achieve and what's feasible to actually achieve. When you get pushback from your constituents on something like a mandate for a fee to help underwrite stormwater remediation, what do you tell them? I mean, you are now in a position that you've got to fix this problem. This is a real problem. There is a mandate to fix the problem.
Right.
How you pay for it is perhaps going to be up to individual counties. But do you get pushback about, you know, upgrading and modernizing systems and monitoring when it comes to the actual projects you're doing? Are they opposed to that?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a lot of it's communication. It's listening to the business community who 9 times out of 10 has to design these and deal with the increased cost. Even in a new project, it's dealing with your constituents who, let's face it, over the last 10 years have seen stagnant wages and increased cost in a lot of other areas of their normal day lives that they need to balance that. So it's really finding the skill to talk to them and find a way to meet the goal without being, you know, too overly aggressive in fees or the way we approach it.
But there's no dedicated source of funding for stormwater remediation in Harford County.
Yes, there is. There's a recordation tax.
And that's going to generate, you know, a tiny fraction of what you actually need to do it. So it's kind of a pay, you even put it in your plan as a pay-as-you-go approach.
Yeah.
And you think that's going to be adequate.
You're seeing a lot of counties move in that direction. Of course, the state mandate was removed, and the goal still remains there. I mean, I had to communicate to a lot of our citizens that, in fact, the state legislature did take away the mandate for the fee, yet if you read the bill, it is just as aggressive in the goals that you have to reach down the road. So we realize that, and we're trying to find a roadmap to do that, and we think through the recordation tax and using bond funding that we can reach that goal. I've talked to the Secretary of MDE, Secretary Grumbles, and he's looking for counties to show that dedication and that progress. And we'll be able to show that progress.
And we're going to take a little break for the news, and we'll talk about some of the ways you're going to achieve that progress.
Okay.
All right, Barry Glassman is here. He's the Harford County Executive. That's our Focus on the County series here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. More coming up after a break. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Barry Glassman, the Republican first-term county executive of Harford County. Our conversation is part of our Focus on the Counties series. Before we continue our discussion with Mr. Glassman, this update to a segment that we had earlier in the series with Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. We talked to him about efforts to make affordable housing more available by making it illegal for landlords to deny housing to tenants who use government vouchers to pay part of their rent. There are currently about 6,100 households who use vouchers in Baltimore County, about half of which are on the eastern side of the county, which includes Dundalk and Essex. This legislation is designed to deconcentrate the homes that are subsidized by what are usually referred to as Section 8 vouchers. So Baltimore County negotiated a settlement in a discrimination complaint raised by HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And as part of that settlement, Kevin Kamenetz was required to introduce legislation petition to the Baltimore County Council, making it a crime to deny housing to people who use Section 8 vouchers. The council rejected that bill on Monday by a vote of 6-1. The Sun reported yesterday that the county is required to reintroduce the bill in 2018. I reached out to Kevin Kamenetz yesterday for a comment. In an email, he said, quote, "I'm disappointed that the source of income discrimination housing legislation did not pass today, but I'm encouraged by the incredible support that it received over the past few months. The discussion that took place really helped educate the public as to why such legislation is good public policy. The deconcentration of poverty remains a very important goal and one to which I remain committed." So he seems to be saying there that there is great support for this legislation, although, again, the council rejected his bill by a vote of 6-1. So now we turn again to Harford County Executive Barry Glassman. While we're on the subject of affordable housing, Mr. Glassman, where does Harford County stand in that? About 28% of students in your schools receive reduced price lunches. The average rent in Harford County, according to some documents on the county website, is about $1,100 a month, and the average home price nearly $300,000 in Harford County. That doesn't sound cheap. How do folks who are on the lower side of the income scale do when it comes to housing in Harford County?
Fortunately, we're sort of at the beginning curve, and I think you mentioned it earlier, as Harford County still is in that transitional phase from a historically rural county to a suburban county. We're kind of in the middle of that. So we're sort of ahead of the curve on the housing. If you travel through Harford County, you'll just see a lot of new apartment complexes coming online to provide additional affordable housing. So we're moving in that direction. That's something my administration is watching closely. As chair of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council, we did recently agree to work with some other suburban counties in the Maryland to provide additional slots for affordable housing, and that was worked out with HUD and with the Baltimore Metropolitan Council. So we are beginning to keep an eye on that as we move forward and develop into what I would say a more metropolitan region in the state of Maryland.
That notion of being a more metropolitan area is, I think, to a certain degree, kind of problematic for certainly people who've been in Harford County all their lives, like you. I mean, you grew up in Harford, in a Harford County that was considerably more rural than it is today. The largest segment of your population is between the ages of 20 and 44. These are young people who demand amenities. They demand things that suburban or urban lifestyles provide that rural lifestyles tend not to provide. How do you negotiate that tension?
It's a struggle at some point in time. I, you know, grew up as a Harford County farm boy. You're right, and we had maybe one mall, the Harford Mall, and Main Street of Bel Air was sort of where you went to get your groceries and went to the department store. As we've grown over the year, particularly during the 90s when we really grew and created the development envelope where we were building an elementary school a year and saw a great influx of folks for affordable housing. Back then, we were cheaper than Baltimore County and many of the other metropolitan counties. But what you've seen over the last 5 years, particularly during the recession, in fact, our home numbers and home construction starts are very flat, and we've seen a stabilizing of that growth curve. We're just now beginning to see apartments and some of the amenities that the millennials are looking for. Complexes that have walkability. You can walk to a nearby shopping center such as the Avenue in Bel Air and Abington, entertainment and so forth. So part of our Harford Next Master Plan was in fact looking at opportunities for mixed use. Mixed use is being used where you have offices, entertainment, restaurant, residential units may be in the same complex. We are actively pursuing those type of complexes in Harford County because we do want to capture that market. It also appeals to senior citizens who are tired of cutting grass and may want to live in the town of Bel Air and be able to walk to the grocery store and to the local entertainment, the bars, restaurants, and so forth. So we have the luxury of looking at what other counties have done. My goal is to make us competitive with Baltimore County and Howard County when it comes to quality housing, whether it's millennial housing, senior housing, and those type of amenities that young people and seniors are looking for.
How specific does the development envelope plan get? In other words, do you have a notion that, say, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, there will be X number of square miles of housing and retail, there will be X number of square miles of agriculture, et cetera? I mean, do you have goals that you think you can meet and keep to? In other words, restrict building when it gets to the point when you start approaching being overbuilt?
Yeah, one of the pressures that we see now is the original envelope that was planned, and I'm old enough to go back to when I was on the county council where the original envelope was designed, has begun to be built out. And that's been exacerbated by the lack of investment in state highway roads. So traffic congestion and so forth is now really creeped into Harford County, particularly during rush hour. And what we've had to do, we just approved our Harford Next land use plan. It does include the smallest increase in the expansion of the envelope. We did two or three minor tweaks. What I did instead was create a study area where we think over the next 10 years may be the next growth area for Harford County. And for the first time, historically, most planners and most counties will just go ahead and increase their development envelope, fill it out, and then deal with school overcrowding, water and sewer obligations, road congestion. We're going to kind of reverse that and kind of do it the right way. Study an area that we think we need to grow in. Make sure that our roads, water and sewer, schools, that the infrastructure is in place before we do a rezoning of that area. And that's one of the pieces of a Harford Next that I'm most proud of. For the first time, we were able to do that. And it's not easy. As you mentioned, there are folks that anytime you talk about a future growth area, become concerned that it will automatically be overbuilt. But I think it was the right thing to do as we go forward to begin to plan out and do it the right way up front.
Harford County Executive Barry Glassman. This is our Focus on the County series on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let's talk a little bit, Mr. Glassman, about crime and law enforcement. Just earlier this year in February, two deputies from the Harford County Sheriff's Office were brutally murdered near a Panera in Harford County, Deputies Mark Loxon and Patrick Daly. You were a legislator for a long time, the county council, the state legislature, the state senate. Now you're an executive. What did you learn about leadership at that terrible moment for your county and certainly for those families?
I was at the Maryland Association of Counties. I'll probably never forget it. I was the budget director. David Brinkley was giving the board of directors a briefing on the upcoming budget. And you get those two phone calls, your pager goes off, and you have to head back to the county. And you really, at that point, I've always kind of, as a native Harford County, and I kind of feel like I represent the best of Harford County, what we're made of. And at that point in time, you have to stand up under a lot of pressure before the cameras and represent the feeling of your constituents, of the county. The fact that to some degree, it never happened before. You need to show strength, compassion. It was a trying day. And those visits, a good friend of mine I served with, Rashern Baker from Prince George's County, actually contacted me on the way up the road and said, you have to be strong. And those visits to the hospital, I came down to shock trauma and Upper Chesapeake to actually see the families and greet them and extend condolences on behalf of the county. Those are Those are tough times, but
Chris, this is long before the police right. shootings in Baton Rouge and in Dallas. I mean, this is a long time before that. And how do you think those events, which have been occurring around the country, are refracted through the prism of your experience in Harford County? And are people fearful in Harford County about crime and about these kinds of things happening?
Well, I think, and I mentioned it back then, I think for Harford County, it was a bit of innocence that was lost. You know, we hadn't had that for a long time. There was some folklore about a deputy that was shot on Main Street maybe 100 years before that, but we had not experienced that type of violence before. So it was new to us. And I think over the last months, as we've begun to heal, there is a lot of nervousness because nationwide there are strong feelings and a heightened degree of anxiety among law enforcement and members of the community. So my goal is to go through this period and work with our law enforcement and the community to heal. And I must say, Harford County really raised over $1 million and really stood up for our law enforcement and for their sacrifice. And the community came together. So it really made me proud that how strong that our community is and how much we support our law enforcement.
Just got a few seconds left, and we'll continue our conversation at another time for sure. But you are a Republican who was swept into office along with three other county executives and a Republican governor, Larry Hogan. You are a Republican in the age of Trump. Do you support Mr. Trump for president? And what is the effect of his candidacy on the Republican Party here in Maryland?
I supported Governor Kasich during the primary election, and right now I... I haven't gotten to the point of supporting Mr. Trump, and probably am more aligned with Governor Hogan than with other officials in the state. So
you are not alone by any means in that. Well, it's really terrific to meet you. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate it, and I look forward to the next time.
Good to be here.
Harford County Executive Barry Glassman. This has been another in our Conversations with Leaders Throughout Maryland in our Focus on the County series. Next week, I'll talk to Jan Gardner, the County Executive of Frederick County. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Another story that we are paying very close attention to, as Nathan has been reporting this morning. On Monday, in Randallstown, Baltimore County Police fatally shot 23-year-old woman named Corinne Gaines. her 5-year-old son was also shot. He sustained non-life-threatening injuries during the altercation. Police say they went to an apartment to serve a failure to appear bench warrant stemming from charges of disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and several traffic violations. After knocking on the door and receiving no answer, police obtained a key from the landlord. They entered the apartment to find Miss Gaines sitting on the floor, pointing a long gun in their direction. A man identified as Kareem Courtney, whom police had a warrant for, fled with a 1-year-old child, leaving Gaines and her son in the apartment. Police say they barricaded themselves in the hallway and made every effort to talk to the woman and encourage her to surrender peacefully. Following a standoff that lasted for several hours, police shot and killed Miss Gaines after they say she pointed her gun at one of the officers and threatened to kill him if he didn't leave the apartment. Her son, Cody, was also shot in the crossfire. He's in stable condition at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Several family members and friends have said on social media that Gaines felt like she's being targeted by the police. She had posted video of the traffic stop in March that led to her being served with the warrant on her Facebook page. The officers involved in the shooting have been placed on administrative leave as the Baltimore County Police continue their investigation. The Washington Post reports that Corinne Gaines is one of 564 people to be fatally shot by police this year, 27 of whom were women, 9 of whom were Black. This is a developing story. We plan to have a much longer conversation about this tragedy as details emerge. For now, we have a link to videos posted by Corinne Gaines and to comments yesterday by Baltimore County Police Chief Jim Johnson on our website. Coming up after a break for the news, theater critic Jaywin Russick joins me for a theater review. Stay with us for that. First now, it's time for the Environment in Focus.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. We're going to have a little theater review now. We usually have those on Monday, but this week we spent our day on Monday speaking with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. As always, we welcome back for our theater chats our good friend and theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Hey, Judy, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
So we're going to talk about a play called The Lord of Flies. It's at Annex Theater here in Baltimore and through the weekend. So the title of the play isn't Lord of the Flies, which was the book, right? It's The Lord of Flies.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously they've shifted the word the here. So I assume that this shift means the Annex Theater has taken some liberties with this famous novel by William Goldie.
Yes, they have taken a lot of liberties, Tom. The show is written by 5 members of Annex's company, all of whom are in the cast, and it is a very, very liberal adaptation. Instead of a group of British schoolboys who are marooned on a desert island, The Lord of Flies is about a group of research scientists on lockdown in a federal lab after some kind of contamination. The scientists are studying infectious diseases, and on this particular day, members of the press are touring the facility. The press includes the audience. We are each given a press badge to wear. In the novel, you may remember, the schoolboys form 2 factions. One is headed by a level-headed boy named Ralph, and the other by a warlike boy named Jack. At Annex, Ralph's counterpart is a calm, methodical scientist named Dr. Wolf, and her rival is a rash, contentious woman named Dr. Jackie Singer.
Well, I'm not playing around anymore. It's time to choose a real interim director. Hands up, who thinks Wolf should quit calling the shots, and who thinks it should be me?
A little aggression there coming out. Pretty easy here. That was actress Madison Cohn. She's in the Annex Theater's production of The Lord of Flies. Now, it does sound as if there are some, you know, some basic similarities between the play and the novel. Are there more specific parallels as well?
Yes, there are some. There are some basic character types that are very similar and parallel, and there's some names. The novel has a pair of twins. The play has a husband and wife research team called the Doctors Ericsson. There's a sympathetic character named Simon who's in both the novel and the play. In both cases, he comes to a sad end. A radio in the play takes the place of several things in the novel, including the fire that the boys use to signal for help, and pigs figure prominently into the plot of the book and the play. The book's title, you may recall, refers to a severed pig's head that's mounted on a pole and attracts flies and supposedly starts talking to Simon.
I had actually forgotten that.
Oh, well, I'm
so
happy
much
to remind
for reminding
you of that.
Me.
Yes, yes. In the stage play, pigs are research animals. Some of them get loose in their minder. Simon is a veterinary technician, and a radio starts talking to him. He's played with a very gentle spirit by an actor named Jacob Budens. He's a character who is very, very protective of his flock.
First of all, violating OLAW standards for subject treatment would be grounds to discredit any of this facility's findings. Second of all, it's ridiculous to act like the pigs are a threat to anyone, and resorting to violence just because we're in a stressful situation isn't going to get anyone out of here, and you're smarter than that. You can't seriously be suggesting that we run around slaughtering animals.
That's Jacob Budens in The Lord of Flies at the Annex Theater. So, here's the thing. There's this famous source material, this novel by William Golding. Do you get something more out of this interpretation than out of just, you know, reading the book?
Well, I'm not sure if the setting and turning the characters into adults instead of children actually enhances the original story and the themes. In the book, we see boys becoming savages, and that suggests that savagery and violence are inherent human traits, even present in children. When the majority of the boys in the book choose to follow an impetuous, warlike leader instead of a thoughtful, rational one, it says something, I think, about the allure of evil. These themes are much less clear and less universal on stage. The program notes mention democratically devising a play with the very same individuals whose job it is to convey a complete breakdown of cooperation. So the process may have had enhanced meaning for the show's creators, but I'm not sure that comes across to the audience.
Yeah, it doesn't always translate. Let's talk a little bit more about the themes in Lord of the Flies. The book was written in 1954. It made a splash for all sorts of reasons. But does it still have modern relevance? Do they touch on that in this production?
Well, somewhat. And you tell me if this sounds relevant, Tom. You have two rival factions. One is led by a bully and the other by someone trying to use reason. So that does seem relevant to me. On one side, you have a rational approach for the greater good. And on the other side, you have something more like a dictatorship with a commanding leader who's able to rouse a crowd. Annex, however, seems to be going in kind of a different direction. Using a research lab, to me, narrows the show's reach. It becomes more about what happens when a controlled environment gets out of control. We heard a minute ago the voice of the bully, Dr. Singer. Here's the voice of reason, Dr. Wolf. She's played by Sarah Jacklin.
Of course the facility has not turned against us. It's a building. It's inert. The only reason that it feels that it's turned against us is because we've gotten so far away from the controlled environment we are used to working in. We've lost our discipline.
Sarah Jacklin in the Annex Theater's production of The Lord of Flies. How's the staging in this production? Does the company make some bold choices there as well?
Well, the staging is very low-tech, almost Doctor Who. As I said, the audience is given press badges, but this is not very interactive until the end. And I don't want to give the end away, but I have to say it doesn't quite have the effect that the company may have intended or hoped for. It sort of peters off and leaves the audience kind of untethered. The bigger difficulty is there are times when the overall focus just doesn't seem real clear. I mean, not only was the show written collectively, it was directed collectively. It's something the company refers to as directorless, but there's a danger here, I think, of being directionless. They do have very, very effective musical choices, from the post-minimalist composer Max Richter to the electronic musician Aphex Twin. The sound designer is Ryan Kidwell, and he says he was listening to Aphex Twin when he was assigned to read Lord of the Flies in ninth grade, and he's always associated the two. It's a very good match for a show that feels a little more like science fiction than a political or sociological allegory. It's a very spooky effect, but not quite as disturbing as Golding's novel.
All right, so The Lord of Flies is at the Annex Theater until Sunday. We've got more information, as always, on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. So, Judy Russick, by the way, this is the final offering in Annex's season. Annex, one of the, you know, many small theater companies that have sprung up here in town over the last 10, 15 years. What's coming up for Annex next season in the 2016-17 offerings?
Yes, well, they are one of the new DIY companies. They have five plays coming up, including Shakespeare's Tempest. It'll be interesting to see what they do with that. They're going to end their season with a new piece called The King of Howard Street in May, and this ties in with their introduction at their new performance space, Le Mondo. I don't know if you've heard about this. Two other companies are renovating three buildings in the 400 block of North Howard Street.
Yeah, that's
along
been going
with
on
them.
For the
yes,
last year.
Yes. Uh-huh. And it's supposed to be ready by then. So there are definitely some exciting things ahead for Annex.
Indeed. Well, we will keep an eye on it as always. Good to see you, Judy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday, we'll talk Olympics. They're going to start on Friday. We'll have our sports guru, Mark Hyman, here to give us a little preview. We'll also talk to our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday, about what we should catch as the summer comes to a close. We've got, another month or so left here in the summer offering. So thanks for being with us today. We hope you'll join us on Friday. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.